How severe is the humanitarian situation in Gaza? How might the struggle for Palestinian self-determination be linked with indigenous sovereignty in Canada? What role might the involvement of activists in the Freedom Flotilla trying to penetrate the Israeli blockade of Gaza be playing in achieving justice for what's being called the world's largest open-air prison? How could supplying hospitals in the region with solar panels contribute significantly to saving lives? On this week's Global Research News Hour, on a week where Canadian activists are departing to take part in the latest attempt to sail into the Gaza Strip and open the port to trade, not aid, for the struggling population, we examine the humanitarian and human rights situation there and examine the perspectives of those involved in trying to make a difference. We'll speak with a steering committee member of the Canadian boat to Gaza and a spokesperson for one of the passengers currently boarding the Canadian boat to Gaza, and will speak with a Canadian doctor who has worked in Gaza and is behind the effort to empower Gaza using solar panels. On this week's show, Palestinian solidarity, Freedom Flotilla 3, and empowering Gaza with solar power. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of June 19th, 2015. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. The NATO expansion started in 1999 when U.S. President Bill Clinton brought into NATO the former Warsaw Pact member nations of Czech Republic, Poland, and Hungary. Then, this threatening, if not aggressive, U.S. move expanded even further in 2004 when U.S. President George W. Bush brought into NATO other former Warsaw Pact members, Bulgaria, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Romania, Slovakia, and Slovenia. Next, in 2009, U.S. President Barack Obama brought into NATO two more former Warsaw Pact nations, Albania and Croatia. Finally, President Obama, in a 2014 very bloody coup d'etat, overthrew the neutralist government of Ukraine and replaced it with a government which is filled with politicians whose political heritage goes back to the pro-Hitler and rabidly anti-Russian political movements in Ukraine during World War II. And these fascist U.S. client politicians have many times spoken of their aim being to join NATO and, with NATO's help, to destroy Russia. America's threat to Russia is very real. That comes from the article, U.S. May Position for a War Against Russia, by Eric Zeus, posted June 17th, originally appearing at Washington's blog. Some 20 Israeli officers and 63 Saudi military men and officials were killed and many others taken captive in a special military operation of Yemen's Ansarullah movement in Amir Khalid Air Base in southern Saudi Arabia, a top security official announced on Wednesday. Quote, the Ansarullah fighters backed by the Yemeni army hit Amir Khalid Air Base in Khamis al-Mushait region in southern Saudi Arabia with a Scud missile and several Najm al-Sakeb striking star missiles last week, killing over 20 senior Israeli officers and 63 Saudi military men and capturing 35 others, unquote, Mehdi Nasser al-Bashi told FNA on Wednesday. He mentioned that the Israeli officers were agents of the Mossad spy agency and were in the region to help the Saudi army and said, quote, at the time of the attack, the Israeli officers were working on a plan to attack some regions of Yemen with prohibited Israeli-made weapons, unquote. The Saudi army claimed that it had intercepted the Scud by two Patriot missiles, but The Arabic language Al Mayadeen news channel showed footage of the missile attack, reporting that it had hit the target. That comes from the article, Yemen, Israeli Mossad and Saudi military killed, taken captive, by Fars news agency, posted June 18th. Fukushima will likely go down in history as the biggest cover-up of the 21st century. Governments and corporations are not leveling with citizens about the risks and dangers. Similarly, truth itself, as an ethical standard, is at risk of going to shambles as the glue that holds together the trust and belief in society's institutions. Ultimately, this is an example of how societies fail. Tens of thousands of Fukushima residents remain in temporary housing more than 4 years after the horrific disaster of March 2011. Some areas on the outskirts of Fukushima have officially reopened to former residents, but many of those former residents are reluctant to return home because of widespread distrust of government claims that it is okay and safe. That comes from the article, What's Really Going On at Fukushima? By Robert Hunziker, posted June 17th, originally appearing in Counterpunch. Lunatics in Washington wanted Russia nuked since early Cold War days. They believed nuclear war was inevitable, so better sooner than later while America had a clear advantage. They weren't alone from that time to now. On Tuesday, Vladimir Putin said Russia will act appropriately to U.S.-dominated NATO's encroachment on its borders. He responded to Washington's intent to position heavy weapons and thousands of U.S. combat forces in Eastern European countries, along with its planned offensive missile defense targeting Russia. Provocations at a time no threats exist except invented ones. That comes from the article, Putin Responds to U.S.-NATO Military Deployments on Russia's Doorstep, by Stephen Lendman, posted June 17th. According to information provided to the New York Times June 13th by U.S. and allied officials, the Pentagon intends to, quote-unquote, pre-position heavy weapons, tanks, guns, etc., sufficient to arm 5,000 soldiers in Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Poland, Romania, Bulgaria, and Hungary. And while Washington has made it known that it does not exclude deploying ground-based nuclear missiles in Europe, Kiev has announced that U.S.-NATO missile interceptors could be installed in Ukraine, similar to those in Poland and Romania. This ignores the fact that Moscow, as it has already warned, will take countermeasures because the launch pads for the interceptors can also be used to launch nuclear missiles. In such a scenario, Trident Juncture 2015, an expression of a strategy of all-out war, is taking place. This is confirmed by the participation of the NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg last week in Austria in the secret meeting of the Bilderberg Group, the same one that the Italian magistrate Ferdinando Imposimato denounced in January 2013 as, quote, one of the leaders of the strategy of tension, unquote. That comes from the article, More U.S.-NATO Wars on the Horizon? NATO launches Trident Juncture 2015. Largest military exercise since the end of the Cold War, by Manlio Dinucci, posted June 18th, originally appearing in ilmanifesto.info. According to The Economist, China's gross domestic product will surpass that of the United States by 2021. But what are the chances that present trends will continue if Beijing is embroiled in a conflagration with the U.S., a conflagration where the U.S. turns China's trading partners against Beijing like it did with Moscow, a conflagration in which more of China's resources are devoted to national defense rather than economic growth, a conflagration in which oil shipments from the Middle East are interrupted or cut off completely? If any of these things were to happen, China would probably slip into recession, dashing its chances of becoming the world's biggest economy. The point here is that China's rise is not inevitable, as many people seem to think. It depends on things that China cannot completely control, like Washington's provocations in the Spratly Islands, which are designed to slow China's growth by isolating Beijing and drawing it into a confrontation that saps its energy and depletes its resources. That comes from the article, 7 days in May, U.S. global hegemony, asymmetric warfare directed against China by Mike Whitney, posted June 17th, originally appearing in Counterpunch. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. The territory known as the Gaza Strip, or Gaza, lines the eastern shore of the Mediterranean Sea, bordering Egypt to the southwest and Israel on the east and north. In spite of the disengagement of Israeli forces nearly a decade ago, the United Nations, international human rights organizations, and the majority of governments and legal commentators around the world consider the territory to be occupied. Israeli defense forces maintain control over all airspace and territorial waters and all crossings in and out of Gaza. The situation fostered dependence on Israel for trade, water, sewage, electricity, currency, communication networks, and issuing IDs and permits to enter and leave the territory. Tensions following the election of the Palestinian Islamic Organization Hamas to power in Gaza provoked tensions with Israel, leading to the 2008 war. And a blockade allowing only limited amounts of medical humanitarian aid through. Israel argues that the blockade is necessary in order to prevent Hamas, deemed a terrorist group by many Western countries, from rearming and launching Palestinian rocket attacks. The restrictions on access to basic building construction materials, medical supplies, and foodstuffs has depressed the economy and standard of living for Gazans and prompted many to refer to the region as the world's largest open-air prison. Since 2008, a unique effort known as the Freedom Flotilla was conceived to try to break through the blockade and bring much-needed assistance to the struggling Palestinian population there who urgently need it. In this hour, we'll be speaking to activists who have been doing what they can to make a difference for this colonized population. We'll speak first about the latest Freedom Flotilla to Gaza, about to set sail from an undisclosed location in the Mediterranean Sea, and then to one of the doctors behind an initiative to power hospitals in Gaza with solar panels. Well, the Canadian boat to Gaza is joining Freedom Flotilla 3. There have been three occasions where the Freedom Flotilla attempted to break the blockade imposed by Israel on the people of Gaza by sailing the ships into Gaza. And just last year, the Gaza's Ark attempted to sail out of Gaza. Well, this time we have yet another attempt at going through the Israeli blockade, and Freedom Flotilla 3 is in effect. We've got an individual named Bob Lovelace who is going to be partaking in the Freedom Flotilla. And joining us now to tell us a little bit more about Mr. Lovelace's motivations is a colleague of his at Queen's University. His name is Richard Day. And he joins us from his home just north of Kingston. So, Richard Day, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for giving us a chance to talk about this.
Okay, now you've also been functioning as Mr. Lovelace's spokesperson, as I understand it. Could you explain to us exactly why he's choosing this approach?
Yeah, the main reason is that it's really unclear what's going to happen, what's going to play out with this with this attempt to bring attention to the blockade. In the past, what has happened is people boats have been boarded, people have been killed, people have been put in jail, people have been deported. So Bob's been on one of these before and has that experience. So my task is basically to talk with the media, but also probably, if things go as they've gone in the past, to be a representative with the Canadian government to try and get them to pay attention to the fact that some of their citizens are detained, which, given the Canadian government's orientation towards anything Israel does these days, they're probably not going to be too supportive of that.
Now, I understand that Bob Lovelace feels a kind of a personal connection to this cause that maybe other solidarity activists don't feel. Do you think you can explain that to us?
Yeah, Bob's a member of the Ardoch Algonquin First Nation, and he's well known as a defender of his people and of his people's land here in Canada. He's been taking principled stands against injustice, against colonialism for several decades, protecting access to traditional rice and grounds, fighting uranium prospecting, and has been on the periphery of debates around land claims. So with his trip to Gaza, he's expressing solidarity with the decolonization struggles of the Palestinians, and as well as, of course, opposition to Israel's illegal occupation and blockade.
Richard Day, do you think you can unpack that for us a little bit? Because I think it's an important point. What are some of the parallels that Mr. Lovelace sees between what's happening in Gaza and the state of the indigenous population within Canada?
Well, Canada is a settler colonial state. It's a place where people like myself, I'm a settler, have come from elsewhere and basically set up shop on someone else's land. And that generally tends to involve getting people off the land. It generally tends to involve cultural genocide. I don't want to use that word too loosely, but I think in the case of the Americas, colonization of the Americas, it applies. It involves basically getting the people and everything they stand for and are out of the way so the land can then be occupied. And there's very, very strong parallels to as well to especially Gaza as something very close to a reservation, an Indian reservation, so-called, here in Canada. Very, very similar things have been done.
I'm kind of curious, and I don't know if you've discussed this with Mr. Lovelace, but in terms of learning certain kinds of tricks of the trade of colonialism, whether it's police forces or government policy, and if one learned from the other, or if they just kind of appear spontaneously because they subscribe to certain similar patterns. Any thoughts about that?
You're meaning from the side of the colonizer? Or the...
Well, I'm in terms of the, in terms of how the colonizers in both cases seem to have similar, if they have similar kinds of habits.
Yeah, well, I wrote a book about this a long time ago, but so I could be that boring academic right now, but I think basically, the whole process comes out of a particular time in, the 15, 16, 1700s, and a particular place, Europe. This is the beginning of so-called saltwater colonialism. If you think about empires prior to that time, well, as far as we know anyway, they would tend to be that, some big warlord arises somewhere and then moves out by land to conquer most of a continent or most of a portion of a continent. And Europe invented this thing of getting in boats and going somewhere else and doing that same kind of thing. Settler colonialism was an invention of Europeans, and the reason that it looks similar all over the world is that Europeans sailed all over the world and brought this invention with them. So the strategies, the tactics, the way of doing this thing was disseminated. And if it's not an abuse of the word work, then it worked really well. And so it has continued to be used up to the present day.
Okay. Now, Bob Lovelace was on the Freedom Flotilla previously.
That's correct.
Now, do you know, are you privy to any experiences he may have had from the previously that may have affected his outlook on or his perspective on this in any way?
I know that he has spoken a lot about feeling the really intense violence of the agents of the Israeli state. And feeling that violence in a context of, what is really, clearly, obviously, in every way, peaceful civil disobedience. And feeling a very militarized response to that. And having been through that sort of thing before, having been to jail, having been involved in, frontline work in Canada, that's something that for him means that he needs to get back there and put himself on the line again. He needs to not be scared away by that, because that's one of the things that seems clear that the Israeli state is trying to do. It calls people who are doing these sorts of things terrorists, which always ups the ante. They're anti-Semitic. I'm apparently anti-Semitic. The emails are already coming in on a fairly regular basis. So there's this real criminalization, demonization, basically a lot of hatred put towards anyone who dares to stand up to these policies of the Israeli state, and he doesn't want to be scared away by that. He's going to get back there. Someone has to take a stand. He's one of the ones who's going to do it.
Mm. I'm wondering then how his family and friends and colleagues like yourself have responded to his decision to participate in this.
Yeah, well, one of the ways I responded was to agree to support in whatever ways I can. My partner and I have helped, you know, a bit towards, you know, the cost of this, as have a lot of people who know Bob. Doing what I'm doing right now is a contribution. I would say pretty much everybody just thinks this is Bob, this is who he is, and we're actually really proud of him, really happy for him that he's got the guts to do what he feels he needs to do, because that's a pretty rare thing, actually, in all places and times, I find.
Richard Day, what does Bob anticipate? What does he expect will come of this action?
There are two things that I want to talk about. One is material, and one of the goals here is to deliver aid to people in Gaza, humanitarian aid, medical supplies, and so on. And the other goal, you mentioned the Gaza Arc. There's still a big pile of local craft-produced materials that need to be brought out of Gaza. So there's this double material goal. And there's also a really important set of symbolic goals, one of them being to bring attention, to return attention to the fact that this blockade is going on. And there's a problem, of course, with anything that persists as an issue for too long. It falls off everyone's attention. There's a new thing going on. That's more exciting. We get fatigued with these kinds of things. And so there's a necessity to keep going back and basically reminding everyone in the world, hey, you know, this is happening. It's still illegal. It's still horrific. After the war last summer, it's even worse than it ever has been. So that's one of the symbolic goals. And another one, particularly as a Canadian, I mentioned this a little bit earlier, is that the Harper government is very, very much in favor of anything that the Israeli state ever says or does, to the point some of us think of basically irrationality. And it's important that people outside of Canada know that Stephen Harper does not remotely speak for all Canadians, that his stance is his stance. He happens to have control of the state, but he definitely doesn't have control of all of our minds and bodies. And there are a lot of us willing to stand up and speak up against those policies.
Richard Day is a colleague and spokesperson for Bob Lovelace, one of the individuals who will be setting sail on Freedom Flotilla 3. Richard Day, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
The following is a clip from Robert Lovelace, recorded about a week before he left Canada to join the Freedom Flotilla to Gaza.
My name is Robert Lovelace, member of the Ardoc Algonquin First Nation, and also a professor at Queen's University. I'll explain to you why the people of Gaza and Palestine have become so important to me, and why I support their struggle for liberation and against the oppression that they experience under settler colonialism, the way our ancestors did. You see, our history and the history of other peoples who have been colonized is very much the same. There are many similar intersections. Colonialism is not a novel experience. It's experienced by many peoples around the world. Our land was taken over by settlers only 200 years ago. And during that time, our people were marginalized. They lost their ability to speak their own language. They lost their ability to use the land in productive and sustainable ways. Our ancestors had to migrate to other places for protection and to make a living. And we became a minority in our own homeland. We experience poverty and mental health issues. Those who survived either knuckled under or became a culture of resistance. The people of Palestine have also confronted settler colonialism. And this is why I see the strong similarities between what has happened to our ancestors, to us, and to the Palestinian people. In a week or so, I'll be traveling to the Eastern Mediterranean to join Freedom Flotilla 3. The reason I'm joining the flotilla for the third time and have been a supporter of challenging the illegal blockade of Gaza by Israel is because as an Aboriginal person, I know that our liberation, the end of our oppression, is tied with everyone's oppression, with Indigenous people around the world. And if I can do my bit, my little bit, to help with the global issues, then I'll be helping people here at home. I am so fortunate to live here in a forest on lands that our ancestors cultivated and used in a sustainable way. But I know that I can't live well because others suffer. And therefore I have to take action. My action at home has been to protect the land and the water from exploitation, from additional settlements, from mining, from taking our wild rice away. But it can't just be here. We have a responsibility to our brothers and sisters in humanity who live all over this world and who are, like us, have fought and continue to fight colonialism. The people of Gaza have a right to build an economy. They have a right to fish in the sea. They have a right to use international waters. They have a right to explore for mineral resources in offshore areas of their territory. They have a right to garden and to farm in the soil of their homeland. No one has the right to take that away from them. And they have the right to raise children free of poverty, free of fear, and able to make good relations with their neighbors. The Creator has given us a beautiful creation to live within and to use and sustain ourselves. And we need to find a way to live in peace with other people and with the other creatures that live in this world with us, that are so important to our livelihoods and our way of life. Humanity is like a tree. It has a strong, strong trunk that holds many branches. All of us share qualities of life. We all have language and song and thought and feelings. And our branches represent the cultures that are part of our environments in which we live. There's enough sunshine for every branch. I hope you can do your part in making sure that the Palestinian people have the sunlight that they need and the space to grow.
You can find out more about Robert Lovelace and stay updated on his journey by visiting his Facebook page, Bob Lovelace Decolonization Blog. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Joining us now to talk more about the Freedom Flotilla 3 and Canada's participation in it is a steering committee member for the Canadian boat to Gaza, and he's also a past participant in the Freedom Flotilla. His name is David Heap. He joins us from London. How are you doing, David?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on the show.
For sure. Now, Freedom Flotilla 3... do you want to remind our listeners what inspired this particular form of solidarity action with the people of Gaza?
So going back to 2008, the year after the total blockade was decreed, right? There have been progressive closures on Palestinian freedom of movement, especially in Palestinians in Gaza, since about 1990 or 91. But the most radical loss of freedom of movement came in 2007. There was a civil society response in 2008 of five voyages that actually sailed and reached Gaza from small boats that reached Gaza up until the end of 2008. In 2009, there were a number of attempts that were attacked. So in 2010, the decision was to sail with multiple boats. So that was the first Freedom Flotilla. The one that people probably would remember, the name Mavi Marmara, perhaps, the boat, the very large boat from Turkey that was attacked by Israeli occupation force commandos, which resulted in 10 deaths and dozens of injuries. The Canadian parts, there were a couple of Canadians there at that time, but the Canadian boat arose from that. The following year, we actually, right after the attack on the Mavi and the rest of the first flotilla, we began organizing to have a boat in the second flotilla in 2011 and raise funds. And eventually the Tahrir tried to sail as part of the Freedom Flotilla in 2011, in this time of year, 4 years ago, in June and July. We were stopped by the Greek Coast Guard because the Israeli occupation had sort of outsourced their blockade from Palestinian waters off Gaza to European ports. So we were stopped, in our case, just outside of a port in Crete. We then sailed with a smaller group of people in November 2011, the Canadian boat together with the Irish boat, the Sirsha. So the Tahrir and the Sirsha sailed in 2011. The 2012, a boat started from Sweden, sailed the Estelle. And in the last leg of that, there was a Canadian former member of parliament, Jim Manley, on board with that group. So in 12, 13, beginning of 2014, we had a different project that still challenged the blockade with direct action, but from the inside out, we were working on rebuilding a boat we called Gaza's Ark in Gaza to challenge the blockade, sailing out from the port of Gaza with export goods from the Palestinian economy. That boat was ready to sail, but in last summer, and had export contracts worth more than $25,000 from purchasers around the world, but was shelled during the assault on Gaza last summer and burned. So we're back to the third flotilla sailing from outside in again with a variety of boats. A boat again left Sweden last month and has visited a number of European ports and is currently in port in Sicily. And it will be joined by at least two others from other Mediterranean ports in the coming days.
Is there anything about Freedom Flotilla 3 that's maybe different? Does it have a specific mission this time that differentiates it from previous flotillas?
I think Bob Lovelace's participation, and I hope you can listen to some of the interviews that he did before he traveled, really highlights the fact that this is a mission about Indigenous people's rights. So Bob makes the parallels between what he calls Gaza, the largest Indian reservation in the world, and the rights that have been taken away from Indigenous peoples in Turtle Island by settler colonialism. So I think that linkage is particularly important. The fact that we're reaching out, we're more international than ever. We have representatives from South Africa and New Zealand on board. So it's really, if anything, it's accentuating the internationalism, but also the anti-colonial flavor that for Canadians, we need to know that when we sail against the blockade of Gaza and for Palestinians' right to freedom of movement, we're also sailing against the Harper government's settler colonial approach in this country to the indigenous peoples of where we live. So making those linkages more clear is part of what we're doing, because our political work really, even though the boats sail in the Eastern Mediterranean, our political work is here at home in Canada.
Yeah. Now, considering that the history just within the Freedom Flotilla background, were there any lessons that has been learned by the movement from those previous encounters?
To be flexible, I think, is important. In June 2011, we had very large gatherings in Athens and press conferences, which were great. I mean, we had Bob Lovelace together with Alice Walker from the U.S. boat for the Gaza, and Henrik Mankell from Scandinavia, you know, very, very important international figures. But of course, if you get everybody together in very public acts before you sail, it makes it easier to stop us, right? So later in 2011, we were a little bit more discreet about our departure until we were in international waters. You know, we haven't announced yet where the other boats will join. We'll join the one that's already in Palermo, where they will meet up. But, you know, we have this dynamic between being as public as possible, but also keeping information, a reasonable amount of information, confidential until we're ready to release it. So, but also being flexible about strategies and not always doing the same things. So we don't have the resources of the state that's trying to block us and maintain their occupation of Palestine, but we do have the goodwill of civil society movements throughout the world working on our side.
Is there anything noteworthy about how elected politicians responded to the treatment of Canadians in past flotillas?
Well, I think the noteworthy thing that people in Canada need to know is that we're really lagging behind the response in Europe. In Canada, we were able to have Jim Manley, as I said, a former New Democrat MP, on board. In Europe, it's quite normal for sitting MPs from a number of European countries to participate in the vote, in the missions, and even if, when they're on board or not on board, for them to actively and publicly support what's going on. In Canada, we have exactly three. The full caucus of Quebec Solidaire in Quebec, in the National Assembly of Quebec, has come out in support. In fact, they had a statement yesterday when our fourth delegate left Quebec City. Christian Martel, a retired trade unionist from Quebec City, left yesterday, and Quebec Solidaire was there speaking in support of the flotilla. Apart from that, it's pretty well a desert in North America as far as elected politicians. So that's an important contrast, because I would say in Europe, the movement has moved farther. I don't really blame the politicians. You know, I engage with them all the time, but the important thing to move is civil society. It's not politicians. When the people lead, eventually the leaders will follow. So what we're really working on here is moving civil society, trade unionists, peace groups, faith groups, campus groups, and so forth, such that consensus among civil society groups in the population realize that this isn't a matter that we can leave to politicians to decide, right? We need to make our demands repeatedly and publicly in such a way that eventually it becomes impossible for politicians to ignore. Another lesson from 2011, and I think this is an important one, Alice Walker at that press conference in Athens made a very important point, which is that for her, and this is somebody who's, you know, she's got half a century of experience in the civil rights movement in the States, she made the comparison by saying that the movement to end the blockade of Gaza is like the freedom rides of our time. And for your listeners who might not remember, the freedom rides in the early 1960s, where people went to the southern U.S. to act in solidarity with African Americans fighting segregation. The important thing about that is to remember that the real dangers and the real heroes of this, in that case, were the African-Americans who fought segregation every day. And in our case, you know, the Palestinians who go out and plant their fields and fish their waters, or try to fish their waters and feed their families and have an independent sovereign economy, are the real heroes. We get to stand with them for a brief period of time and hopefully draw some of the world's attention to them. But the other thing is that people went back year after year after year. There wasn't any easy, fast successes with the Freedom Rides or with the boycotts and with the the bus boycott in Selma, or the marches from Selma to Montgomery in Alabama. They got beat up violently many times before there were any breakthroughs. So I think the idea that people say, oh, well, the flotilla is done now. Well, no, our work isn't done until Palestinians have freedom of movement. Just as people continued to go on the Freedom Rides and continued to go on the marches against segregation until victory was achieved.
I guess I have one last question. Considering you yourself were detained on one of these flotilla ships, I'm curious to know, because you don't strike me as being a babe in the woods. I was wondering if there was anything that surprised you personally about the way the Israeli military and governing forces dealt with you.
Nothing surprises me when you're dealing with an unaccountable rogue state, right? Israel does what and the Israeli forces do what they get away with, and they know they'll get away with it because governments like ours give them carte blanche. They're never held accountable by the Harper government in Canada or other world governments. So they will continue to get away with things seizing an international civilian ship in international waters with a course towards Palestinian waters, right? It's going nowhere near Israeli waters. It's going right by Israeli waters, not even entering or directing itself towards Israeli waters. And yet they say they're defending Israeli waters, right? So no other state in the world today would get away with doing that. They get away with it because our government allows it, among others, right? So I think where people should be shocked is not the fact that the Israelis steal international boats, kidnap international citizens. They do this all the time to Palestinians. They use tasers on us. Well, they use tasers and much worse on Palestinians week in, week out. That they do this is not the shocking thing. That our governments, in our name, allow them to get away with it. That's what we should be shocked about, and that's what we should be changing in our countries.
David Heap is a steering committee member for the Canadian Boat to Gaza contingent of the Freedom Flotilla 3, and also a past participant in the Freedom Flotilla. David Heap, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the show. I look forward to speaking to you again sometime.
For sure. Take care.
Take care. Bye.
Empower Gaza is a joint initiative involving the United Nations Development Program and Islamic Relief Canada to provide a renewable, reliable source of energy for intensive care units, operating rooms, and emergency departments in the besieged Palestinian territory of Gaza. Dr. Benjamin Thompson is one of the physicians behind the project. He has also been to Gaza and conducted his operated there as a physician. He joins us now from Kingston. Hello, Dr. Thompson. Welcome for help. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Okay, now, could you tell us a little bit more about this initiative? It involves using solar panels to power hospitals, correct?
Yes, having been to Gaza, working in the healthcare sector for several years now, there's a few major challenges that the healthcare workers in Gaza face on a daily basis, and none is more pronounced than the energy blackouts, which affect every part of the infrastructure in the healthcare sector. So whether you're working in the emergency room with no lights and unable to examine your patients, or unable to work in the operating room without using a cell phone to illuminate a patient, whether it's that a respirator in the intensive care unit stops because the backup generators fail, it affects every critical component of the hospital. And so, hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. So we, having been to Gaza, we really wanted to find a long-term sustainable solution to the energy crisis that essentially results in people's lives being lost in hospitals in Gaza. So in conjunction with the healthcare workers on the ground, we devised a program which would install solar energy to supply all the critical infrastructure of hospitals in Gaza. So we know it works, and we know it works because, in fact, the Al-Shifa Hospital, which is one of the major hospitals in Gaza City, already has a solar project. And since that solar project has been initiated, there has not been one blackout in the Al-Shifa Hospital. So we know it works. So it wasn't so much whether it works, it's how do we get it to expand to the other major hospitals in Gaza so we can save lives and end blackouts in the hospitals. So Dr. Loubani and myself have been going to Gaza for several years now. And when we worked together with the healthcare workers in Gaza, we created a program that would set up solar power in the major hospitals in Gaza. The United Nations Development Program signed on almost immediately. They recognized the critical nature of this project. Islamic Relief Canada signed up as the charitable sponsor in Canada. And we're running an online Indiegogo campaign to raise $200,000 over the period of 60 days. We've almost reached our goal. We're almost at $170,000 with about just over a week left. And that will supply one of the hospitals. That will supply one of the hospitals. And we're hoping to continue raising money until all the major hospitals in Gaza are funded and supplied with solar energy.
May I ask where the where do the solar panels themselves come from? Are they brought in? Are they assembled in Gaza? And who puts them up on the roofs? Like who all is involved in this?
Yeah, so the on-the-ground logistics partner is the United Nations Development Program. They have been involved in one project already in Gaza, which was successfully installed solar power at one of the hospitals in Gaza. With regards to the specifics of what type of panels and the engineering specifics, we have actually been involved with Mr. Ani Naim, who is the head engineer in Gaza for the electrical sector. And in conjunction with Mr. Ani, we've created a local system that will work well with the pre-existing infrastructure and will meet the needs of the healthcare workers on the ground. And with regards to how everything gets in and gets out, that's really a administrative issue which the United Nations Development Program thankfully is involved in. And they have done this before, and they're doing it for all of our hospitals that we're going to be supplying in the Empower Gaza campaign.
Okay, now I wonder if I could just get you to back up a little bit, because you were talking about from your own experience about the difficulties of working in a situation where electrical power is not reliable. I'm curious, are there any things that we tend to take for granted here that maybe some simple things even that electrical power enables that are absolutely critical? I mean, obviously you don't want to be operating in the dark, but I mean, other sorts of obstacles created by that lack of reliable power?
Well, you know, I think it's important that we reinforce the fact that the electricity crisis in Gaza expands to all parts of life. So we're not talking just about hospitals. We're talking about in people's homes, in people's businesses, on the roads where there's really no traffic lights. The region is dependent almost entirely on fuel and diesel for their electrical needs, simply because the blackouts do last, in general, a minimum of 16 hours a day, and that's in all sectors. Now, my experience is as a physician, and as such, I wanted to focus our efforts from a humanitarian side on the hospitals. And so within the hospitals, really everything requires power, whether you're talking about running a blood test so you know what someone's blood count is or someone's kidney or liver function is doing. That's reliant on energy. Whether you're running a dialysis machine or an operating room or an intensive care unit or an emergency room, all of those things run on electricity. And when electricity fails, those critical areas no longer function. It's that simple. So when someone's respirator turns off, that person dies. When someone is reliant on 3 weekly treatments of hemodialysis treatments because their kidneys have failed, when that's no longer available, that patient dies. When someone needs emergency surgery, but we can't see in the operating room, that person dies. So it's really a it's really not complicated at all. Electricity is absolutely crucial or people die. It's really that simple. Now, as it turns out, we're very lucky because we're following a project that has already been a great success. And if you look at Haiti, Nepal, India, even within Gaza, there's successful solar energy projects that have ended blackouts in the hospitals in which they've been installed. And there's absolutely no doubt that that saves lives. So it's really not a matter of if it saves lives. It's really not even a matter of how it saves lives. How it saves lives is simple. You are absolutely critically requiring electricity to function a healthcare facility. So there's no doubt it works. The major issue for Empower Gaza is expanding it so that we can supply more hospitals with it to save more lives.
Mm-hmm. Now, I could add a bit of an editorial comment. It certainly sounds like a wonderful initiative, though. The fact is, it seems to me that a lot of the with the electrical grid and the shattered infrastructure, it's Israeli government or Israeli Defense Forces attacks that are principally responsible for that. So you could talk about the lives that are being compromised as secondary effects from that. And it seems to me that, recently saw an article talking about how a clinic was attacked because it was claimed that it was providing some sort of support for Hamas. And you've probably heard this argument about how, human shields and whatnot. And I don't know, is it an insignificant consideration that that certain facilities could provide targets for the next Israeli attack? I mean, is that something that that might on some level complicate your efforts?
So there's no doubt that there are some very complicated politics in the region. I don't claim to be a politician. I do openly admit that I'm a physician and I'm interested in the humanitarian needs in Gaza. And there's absolutely no doubt whatsoever that there is a humanitarian crisis. There's no doubt that the international players, the government, and even some non-government organizations that have committed to provide assistance in light of this humanitarian crisis, most of these groups have failed to do so. And the majority of the commitments that have been provided, verbally, the money just hasn't come in and the commitments just have not been fulfilled. So you're absolutely right. Up until, so with regards to the first question, are there political issues? Yes. There absolutely are very complicated political issues in the region. The nice thing about this project, the Empower Gaza project, is a very clean one. So it is not a political project. We are not really concerned about Israel versus Palestine. We're not concerned about Hamas versus Fatah. We really don't care. What we're really interested in is the humanitarian crisis and the fact that because of the humanitarian crisis, people in Gaza are dying. And this is something that is readily fixable. There's a solution that is available. It is something that we are hoping to provide with the Empower Gaza campaign. So that's how we're looking at it. I must admit, I'm not a politician. And because I'm not a politician, I don't claim to know politically what the answers are to what your question is. But I know that from a humanitarian perspective, there's absolutely no doubt what the solution is. It's solar energy. And that's something that the healthcare workers in Gaza have said to us. And from our own experience working in the Gaza healthcare system, it's absolutely no doubt that it'll save lives.
Now, as we're having this conversation, I noticed there's a little over a week left in your fundraising drive to get you to your $200,000 goal. Is there anything you'd like to share with our listeners about how they can get involved in helping out?
Absolutely. So there's really a number of ways in which Empower Gaza supporters can become involved. There's a website which can be accessed at empowergaza.org. That's empowergaza.org. And that will immediately link to the Indiegogo campaign, which is raising money for one hospital. And all those funds will go to the Islamic Relief Canada and then subsequently to the United Nations Development Program. That's one way in which you can get involved. The other alternative is if you would like to attend one of the events. There are events in Michigan, as well as in Mississauga, as well as in Halifax. The details of each of those events, which will take place in the next 8 days, that can be found at, again, the empowergaza.org site. As well, we have an email, info@empowergaza.org. And any questions, please feel free to contact us. We're elated that over 800 people have donated to this campaign, but even more people have been involved supporting us in other ways. And we're always open to new ideas about how we can overcome the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. We're always open to new thoughts and suggestions.
Dr. Benjamin Thompson, thank you very much for sharing this information with us, and good luck with your campaign.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Dr. Benjamin Thompson is one of the three physicians backing the Empower Gaza initiative.
An update. As of this broadcast, Bob Lovelace left a message stating he was on board the Swedish-flagged Marianne and had taken on the role of nonviolence trainer. He spoke highly of the crew and the support they were receiving and that they were about to set sail. Stay updated on his movements by visiting his Facebook page, Bob Lovelace Decolonization Blog. We've come to the end of the Global Research News Hour for this week. We'd like to thank Tyler Levitan of Independent Jewish Voices for his assistance in tracking down interviews this week and supplying us with the audio from Bob Lovelace's video. We'd also like to wish all the passengers aboard the Freedom Flotilla ships a safe and successful journey. The Global Research News Hour airs on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg every Friday at 1 p.m. Central Time, as well as on different times on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States, including the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. Our shows are podcast at globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. We'll close the show now with a song by the Arabic Palestinian rap band DAM. It's called Min Erhabi, which means who's the terrorist. The song asks the world to question who is the terrorist when the majority of victims of Israeli aggression in Palestine are women and children. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.
Palestinian rights. I think they're the most terrorized, or at least with the Iraqi people, they're the most terrorized people on earth and have been for so many years. Practically every Palestinian lives in constant harassment, threat of violence, humiliation, been that way for a long, long time.
مين إرهابي؟ أنا إرهابي؟ كيف إرهابي وأنا عايش ببلادي؟ مين إرهابي؟ أنت إرهابي؟ مكلني وأنا عايش ببلادي؟ قتلني زي ما تلت إجدادي؟
أجل القانون
عن فاضي ما أنت يا عدو بتلعب دور الشاهد المحامي والقاضي علي قاضي نهايتي بلادي حلمك انقل فوق معنى آلية حلمك لآلية تصير بالمقابر أكترية ديمقراطية؟ والله إنكم ناسية من كثر ما اغتصبتوا النفس العربية هبلت ولدت ولد اسمه عملية انفجارية وهنا ديت ارهابية يعني ضربتني وبكيت سبقني واشتكيت لما ذكرتك انك بديت نصيت وحكيت ما انتو بتخلوا ولاد صغار يرموا حجار ما لهمش اهل يدبوهم بالدار ايش كنو نسيت انو استحق ضب الاهل تحت الحجار وقلق لما وجع الفار بتناديني ارهابي
مين ارهابي انا ارهابي كيف ارهابي وانا عايش في بلادي مين ارهابي انت ارهابي ماكلني وانا عايش
عايش في بلادي. ليش ارهابي؟ عشان دمي مش هادي. حامي عشان رافع راسي وارض بلادي. قتلوا حبايبي انا لحالي. اهلي تشردوا راح اضلي انادي. انا مش ضد السلام, السلام ضدي. علي بده يدي تراثي بده يمحي. واللي بيحكي كلمة بشد وراه همة بيكون زلمة.